Welcome to the 330th episode of the 4th and 24 podcast with Patrick Winograd. I'm your host, Randy Winograd. In this edition of the podcast, our topics are a review of Patrick's weekend predictions, a look at conference championship week football action and a preview of the CFP, our look at week 14 of the NFL season, and our weekly recap of the past week's basketball action in both the NBA and college basketball. So with all that content that we need to cover here in a quick period of time, let's jump right in with a look at Patrick's weekend predictions. In college football, Patrick went 2-2. In the NFL, Patrick went 2-2. In the NBA, Patrick was a perfect 4-0. And in college basketball, Patrick went 1-3, meaning for his weekend predictions last weekend, Patrick went 9-7. And that brings him to a 1,410 and 892 overall record, a 61.3% winning percentage. Patrick, your thoughts on your weekend predictions?
Well, I thought for once I finally had a good NBA week. Well, I won't say good. I think I've had maybe a 3-1 week or maybe a 2-2 week here and there. But a great NBA week, a 4-0 predictions week. There, a lot of them were really close. Well, two of them were really close, and then the other two not so much. I guess I'll start there since I started talking about it. The Magic beat the Heat 106-105, which was a correct prediction for me. Obviously, all these correct predictions because I won 4-0. The Nuggets beat the Hawks 134-133. The Cavs beat the Spurs 130-117. And the Rockets beat the Suns 117-98. So, good week of predictions there in the NBA. Of course, other leagues, maybe not so much, continuing with the theme of basketball, but going to college. I picked all the home teams, really. There were two important games that were home games for Big Ten teams and two neutral site games. I picked against the Big Ten once. I picked Tennessee to beat Illinois, and Illinois was the one who actually came up with the victory, 75-62, because that really wasn't a neutral site game. It was in Nashville. So, you know, that's not very close to Illinois' campus, but pretty close to Knoxville. So I picked Tennessee in that one, thought they would bounce back from that loss to Syracuse, but it was not to be for them. So they actually lost that game, Illinois, going on the pseudo road, you could say, winning that one. Speaking of going on the pseudo road, also played in Nashville the night before. Number 11 Gonzaga beat number 18 Kentucky 94-59. Of course, Kentucky a little farther away from Nashville than Knoxville is, but Gonzaga a lot farther away than either of those schools are. So, but Gonzaga getting a huge win on the board, and I'm not saying huge in terms of, you know, the magnitude of how important the victory is, because I think we all know that Kentucky is having a down year and haven't really figured things out, but huge in the margin category, of course. And then there were two teams in the Big Ten who were playing home games, Michigan State and Purdue, that I picked. Michigan State, technically, I guess, would have been an upset over Duke. I don't even know if they were favored in that game. But they lost 66-60 at home. Duke stays undefeated, gets to 10-0. They might be the only 10-0 team in the country. They played a ton of games early in the season. And then number 10, Iowa State, they went on the road and beat number 1, Purdue, 81-58. I did think about picking Iowa State in this game just because I felt off not picking a single road team, but I didn't end up doing it, and they proved me wrong. I thought, you know, Iowa State has a good front court, but I thought still Purdue's would be enough to kind of just handle them, but the guard play from Iowa State, especially defensively, limiting Fletcher Lawyer to a really bad game, and Braden Smith doing his normal thing, which he's always going to do against everybody, but it was enough for Iowa State to just come out and demolish that game. So the only one I got right was the Gonzaga game, but overall, not too dissatisfied with those predictions. It's hard when there's a weird mix of neutral court and home games, and, you know, you don't really know that much about all these teams this early in the season. There's not much separation to go off of. But in football, in college football, I mean, two really close games that I lost and then correctly picked the blowouts that I think everybody predicted. Texas Tech and Georgia, of course, beating BYU and Alabama respectively in their conference championship games. They gave up a combined 14 points, 7 each. They scored a combined 62 points, 34 for Texas Tech and 28 for Georgia. So both of those were correct. But then number 2, Indiana pulled off the upset against Ohio State, 13-10. Eerily similar to the Michigan game from last year for Buckeye fans, with the score and Jaden Fielding missing chip shot field goals. And then Duke beat number 17 Virginia 27-20 in overtime. I had Virginia winning that one. We'll talk about the playoff significance of that later. And then finally in the NFL, on Thursday Night Football, the Lions beat the Cowboys 44-30. Cowboys still don't have a defense. The Jaguars beat the Colts 36-19, of course. We'll talk about the big news of that game later and what that means, but Jaguars for now getting the important divisional win. And the Packers beat the Bears 28-21. That was the other one I got right along with the Lions game. Really good game there in Lambeau. And then the Chargers beat the Eagles 22-19 in overtime. And it's pretty rare that I would say this, but that was not a good game in overtime. That was one of the worst games of football I've watched in a very long time, especially played between two teams that are in the playoff picture in their conferences. But I got that one wrong as well.
Extremely sloppy game there. All right, well, Patrick's predictions for next weekend will be posted, as always, on Thursday on our social media handles at 4th and 24. Let's now turn our attention to our weekly look back at college football with, obviously, the focus on the conference championship games.
Starting in the American, Tulane, the number 20 team in the country, beat North Texas, number 24, 34-21. Tulane, a 24-7 start in the first half. It's a very important win for them, obviously, because it meant that they were going to make the college football playoff, regardless of other results. But a team that did need other results to go their way was number 25, James Madison. They needed to win first. They did that. Shut out Troy in the second half, ended up with a 31-14 victory. But JMU gets into the playoffs because of that game that we talked about earlier with Duke beating number 17, Virginia. Obviously, the rule is top five conference champions, and since Duke was 8-5 on the season, they were not going to get ranked high enough to overtake JMU or Tulane or North Texas, had any of them won. Obviously, if Troy had won, then I don't know what would have happened. That would have been a conversation between Duke and maybe the Mountain West champion. There's a lot of stuff that could have happened there, but Virginia, of course, one win away from the playoffs against a team they already beat 34-17 earlier in the year. Couldn't get it done. Duke ends up with the overtime victory, and Duke helps out the Dukes and gets them into the college football playoff. Then you have Indiana and Ohio State. Indiana, obviously, as we talked about in predictions, winning the battle for the one seed. Number three, Georgia, knocking Alabama so far down that a lot of people clamored about them maybe missing the playoffs over the margin in that game, but, of course, it didn't happen. And then number four, Texas Tech, actually knocking BYU out of the conversation by dominating that game. BYU took a 7-0 lead and never looked back or never got back to that level. Texas Tech scored 34 unanswered points to end up with a 34-7 victory, which of course means that we now have the playoff bracket. We're not going to actually preview the college football playoff, but obviously some interesting decisions were made in this playoff. I think I talked to you about this before we recorded this, but I think they have the right teams in the playoff. I just think they went in the most roundabout, dumb, confusing, whatever word you want to use, route to actually get to this point. I think things could have been a lot simpler had they just ranked Miami ahead of Notre Dame weeks ago, like they should have been the entire time, instead of just randomly deciding without them playing any games that they should just now be ahead of Notre Dame. Again, nothing changed this weekend because neither of them played a game. It was just weird for that purpose, but I actually do think Miami was the team that deserved to be in. I mean, they've said it. They ended up throwing it around a lot on ESPN eventually, but it was definitely a thing that was, you know, going on social media around for a while, which is, there were 13 times before that two teams ended the season with the exact same record and had a head-to-head matchup. And Miami was the first instance that the playoff committee ranked the team that won the game behind the team that lost the game in such an instance. So I guess you could say they have been consistent about it over the years, but I don't know why they had two rankings separating them this whole time. Doesn't really make much sense from that aspect, but again, I think Miami should have been in. I think they got that right. I guess it was also interesting to see that they just flip-flopped Indiana and Ohio State at 1-2. I almost wonder, just on brand name, had Indiana lost that game or even lost it by some margin, if maybe Georgia would have gotten the number two nod over Indiana at 12-1, and Ohio State would have been number one, obviously, with that win. That's an interesting conversation that obviously will never be resolved. But then you also look at this draw in general, and without getting into the actual predictions, but Texas Tech at 4, you know, they're probably going to end up playing Oregon, but then they play Indiana, in theory. That's not a bad draw for them to make their first national championship game probably ever. And then you look at a team like Georgia, who gets Ole Miss, who they already beat this season with Lane Kiffin, or they get Tulane, who Ole Miss already beat by 35 this season. So, at home, which is where this game's also going to be played anyway, I think best draw, I'm saying Georgia's draw is by far the best. I think Ohio State easily got the worst draw. I think Texas A&M and Miami, look, Miami, regardless of what they've done in some of their games, they very clearly have proven that they can compete at the top. They have just kind of had some lack of motivation, big Carson Beck turnover games. But other than that, they've been a really good team all year long. And then A&M, this is a one-loss team that was, you know, number two or number three heading into 2 weeks ago and just took one loss at Texas, and that was it. They had one slightly off game, and that dropped them five spots. So I would make the argument, and I've said this for a while, I still think A&M's a better team than Ole Miss is. Could even make the argument for them being better than Oregon. I wouldn't go that far personally, but wouldn't be shocked if someone else said it. So I think they got a pretty bad draw if you're Ohio State, because also you're playing Georgia before the championship game, even if you get there. I think, to be honest with you, whoever comes out of this bottom half of the bracket without, you know, going game by game is probably going to win the national championship. I think Ohio State, Georgia, or if somehow Ole Miss or A&M or Miami gutted their way through this part of the bracket, they'd probably have enough momentum to easily beat an Indiana, Texas Tech. I don't have much faith in Oklahoma or Alabama at all. Maybe Oregon would be the only other team at the top that I think could probably come out and beat, or Texas Tech could probably beat one of the teams from the bottom. But it's an interesting discussion. I think, as we said, though, I'm on board with the decision to let Miami in. I think it's stupid that BYU lost by a big margin and Alabama lost by a big margin, but only one of them got punished. But, you know, there are ulterior motives at play. And I think that's the other thing that became abundantly clear this year, because I think another reason why Miami ended up getting in was that they couldn't have zero ACC teams in the playoff. So because the ACC champion wasn't going to be in it, they chose to put in the actual best team in the ACC.
So without belaboring this, you and I talked about it a lot, but people need to understand that this is not a system that is designed to put the best teams in the playoff. This is a system that is negotiated with compromises made with people with differing interests that conflict with each other to forward their own self-interest. So,
which is unfortunate for a system that is supposed to design getting a national championship.
But it is. It's designed to get a national championship in a way where people could agree on how to first figure out who's in the pool of teams, yep, that are eligible. So to your point, we talked about this, the mistake, and Joel Klatt, I'll give him credit, and he agrees with you. He did a great analogy to like eating a hot dog. You don't want to know how the, we don't want to know how the sausage is made. We just love the playoff. And in here, knowing how the sausage or the hot dog is made, it's dirty. It's not perfect. It's not a process that's clean. And so what you should just do is what you said, either have one ranking at the beginning of the process and not show people how the sausage was made, or don't even have any ranking shows to begin with. However, that's part of the money. That's part. So the process, it is a broken process. Notwithstanding that, the results of this broken process got it right. Notre Dame and Miami played each other on the field, and that has to matter. The other thing that people don't understand is the process for how these teams are slotted. It is not, well, let's just sit there and rank people. They put them in pods, and then the teams that fall, 16 pods, I believe it is, and the teams that fall are at the bottom of that pod, they're then slotted in the rankings, and then the three teams that were left go with the next three teams. And so you can have this weird rank choice voting type thing where somebody may have been, if you were in a pod number three, and then the next time around, because three of those teams were left out of the pod, somebody ranks them higher and it scrambles stuff up, and head to head comes into play when you're just trying to decide between two teams. And because of this stupid process that we've talked about, where they show you the interim rankings, Notre Dame was ahead of Miami when there was a team between them. There was not a team between them, obviously, in this final process with BYU losing. We talked about, hey, why does BYU fall, not Alabama? BYU lost to the same team twice. Alabama didn't fall because they lost to a team that they'd already beat on the road that's the number two seed. With that being said, Notre Dame agreed to the system, and next year, Notre Dame fans, you've negotiated a rule for yourself like you always do that says that if you're in the top 12, you're automatically in. So you can cry about it this year, but you agreed to this system, live with the rules, and move on. Finally, regarding the seeding, and I know you want to say something, regarding the seeding about Ohio State falling to two or three, either way, they were going to meet Georgia. The winner of that the Big Ten championship game was going to be the number one seed. There was no way the loser was going to drop to four. They were not going to set up a Big Ten against Big Ten semifinals. And the other thing that's interesting here is you've identified it. That Georgia Ohio State part of the bracket is like filled with powerhouses. The top half of that bracket, they've set it up so that, assuming chalk holds, Indiana or Texas Tech is going to be in the national championship game. And so you're going to have a Cinderella team against a name brand. I don't know whether they do it intentionally or not or subconsciously, but they have set this up for a lot of drama. And I would not overlook Texas Tech. We'll get to our preview next week, but I would not overlook Texas Tech. Your thoughts?
Well, Texas Tech would be my favorite in the top half of the bracket, and I think I've been pretty consistent all year long of saying that I think that team's a lot better than they were ever given credit for. But, you know, Indiana is obviously still a good, really good team, and actually, frankly, if you're looking at likelihood to get there without going too much into predictions, look, Indiana probably, I would say, has a better chance to win the Rose Bowl game by far than Texas Tech does to beat Oregon. But whoever comes out of the Texas Tech-Oregon game, I think, would look pretty good against Indiana. That being said, Indiana already beat Oregon this year.
And we're going to have our preview on the road later, but that five seed has always been pretty attractive. You get a chance to play an easy matchup at home, so you're not stale, and then you get the four seed, your second gamer.
Yeah, I saw a lot of Oregon fans saying that Ohio State fans were complaining about the bye and saying, look what happened to us last year when we played you off the bye. So I think that has been a constant theme that I think will convey again this year, and I think Oregon gets a big advantage out of that because they're not going to lose that game, and they are not going to have to take, you know, 4 weeks off before the Orange Bowl, which Texas Tech will have to be shaking off some rust. But the last comment that I'll make, which is about the actual system itself that you said, you were alluding to the fact that the NCAA Tournament Committee, of course, for basketball, does a seeding reveal before a marquee game on CBS on a random morning in February. It's always the same week, so it is an established week. It's not, I guess I'm saying I shouldn't use the word random. It's not random per se. But they do one reveal. They let you know where the top 16 teams are, and they do nothing else. They don't do all 68 teams in the bracket. They don't go off of who's currently leading their conferences and getting auto bids. They just say the top 16 seeds and how it would be seeded right now, 1 through 4. And then everybody gets to speculate because then they ask them questions about who else did you consider? So you get an unofficial 17, 18, and 19, maybe a 20 and a 21. And then after that, they go back to just doing their discussions on their own, and no one hears about it until Selection Sunday.
All right, one final thought on the process, because we'll do our preview next week. The process actually works 100% how they wanted to design it. They're trying to maximize dollars and eyeballs, and what's happening? Everybody's talking about it. Controversy helps. So everybody's talking about it. They got their own self-interest taken care of as far as a negotiated comp. This is a negotiated compromise playoff. So everybody's talking about it. There's controversy. People watch the shows, but it's terrible in terms of not creating controversy. The NCAA basketball selection show is the perfect way to do it. But this selection process is designed to create eyeballs on TV and controversy with people talking about it.
I would also like to say that if we went back to the 4-team playoff, I would love this playoff of Indiana, Texas Tech, Georgia, and Ohio State. It'd be a great playoff.
It'd be fantastic.
And I don't think there would be no argument about Oregon missing it or Alabama missing it or anybody. No one else could argue they should be in this playoff.
No argument whatsoever. That's a great point. All right. Well, next week we will dig deeper into our predictions. Let's move on. Still talking about football, but let's talk about week 14 in the NFL.
Yeah, it was a week of blowouts, really, for a few teams. The Rams and the Seahawks, namely, protecting their 10-3 record, battling for that one seed in the NFC, just easily dispatching the Cardinals and the Falcons. But elsewhere in the league, a lot of points in some games, and then a lot of low-scoring games in other games. The Lions, of course, as we mentioned in predictions, took down the Cowboys 44-30 on Thursday Night Football. Very important for a team who is in the thick of things for a battle for a playoff spot. Of course, you look at the AFC, and we'll get to some of the nuances of that discussion later. But right now, 8-5 is the last playoff spot. 8-5 is also the first team outs record. But then there's also a 7-6 division winner, obviously, with the Steelers currently. And then in the NFC, the Buccaneers and the Panthers are both 7-6 fighting for that division. But all the other divisions are pretty stacked. They're pretty stacked up. You have, of course, the Eagles leading theirs at 8-5. The Cowboys in second at 6-6-1. And then there is the bigger story in terms of the wild card that the Bears right now at 9-4 are the last team in the playoffs. And jumping ahead to the Bears, they obviously lost this weekend against the Packers 28-21. Packers moving to 9-3-1. So again, that stupid tie against Dallas has the Packers back in first place, which is really funny. But, you know, same number of wins as the Bears, but one fewer loss because of that tie. They also do have the tiebreaker, but there will be no ties with them because they have a tie on their record. So it's pretty much impossible for them to tie with another team, unless, of course, the Bears add a tie to their record. But the Packers at 9-3-1, looking pretty good in that division. And, of course, the Bears, they were the one seed in the NFC heading into the week, technically, over tiebreakers. They are now the 7th seed. So it's pretty crazy that the separation between these teams is that tight. And frankly, you're looking at matchups down the line. You know, the Rams don't play the 49ers again, but say the Rams lose to the Seahawks, they go to 10-4. And then say the Niners have won out heading into their next matchup with the Seahawks. Then you have a point where the Niners can win that game, go from the 6th seed to the 1 seed, and the Seahawks would go from the 1 seed to the 5 or the 7, or the 6th seed. So there's some crazy situations going on in the NFC. But, of course, all of that judged a lot. I mean, for the Lions, you know, they might have a very good season, might end up 10-7, and they might end up on the outside looking in, and it wouldn't be too shocking. I don't think that 10-7 is going to make it, considering that all three of the wild cards already have 9 wins. The Lions also play the Rams, the Steelers, Vikings, and Bears to end the season. So they're going to control their own outcome because of the fact that they're playing other teams directly in contention with them. They have an opportunity to beat the Bears. They have an opportunity to beat the Rams. Both of those teams, obviously, in contention for that final playoff spot. And also the Rams, of course, for their own division. And the Lions still in play for their own division. And then speaking of divisional races, the Bills beat the Bengals 39-34. We talked about the Bengals somehow not being eliminated yet and almost kind of budging their head into the debate in the AFC North. This would have been a big win for them to pick up if they had stayed at 5-8 and then all of a sudden just had divisional games to decide if they could actually make the playoffs or not. They, of course, did not come out with the win. They probably should have. But two straight snaps with an interception by Joe Burrow swung this game in the favor of the Bills, who really needed the win because, again, it's a tight race in the AFC to make the playoffs. And currently Buffalo only in 6th place because they're 2 games behind their division-leading Patriots, of course, who are 11-2 this season. Then you have the Dolphins, who won 34-10. And all of a sudden, the Dolphins at 6-7 on the season, they're not technically out of it. And the reason why I say that, of course, is because there's an interesting battle brewing because currently the Texans and the Colts are tied for the last playoff spot, but the Colts, as I alluded to earlier, they had a big thing happen in their loss to the Jaguars. Daniel Jones out for the season. We're talking about a team that's so desperate for a quarterback that they worked out Philip Rivers last night, who notably, if he didn't come back to the NFL this year, he would be eligible for Hall of Fame voting in a few months because he's been retired for 5 years. He retired in the COVID season, and we're talking about him maybe coming back and playing playoff games for the Colts. Or maybe, well, they probably wouldn't be playoff games because they'd have to get there first, and right now they're not on the right end of that. But playing games that would determine if they make it to the playoffs. And here's the thing. They play the Seahawks, the 49ers, the Jaguars, and the Texans. The worst record of any team that the Colts play in the rest of the season are the 8-5 Texans, who, of course, have one of the best defenses we've seen in years. I don't know who they're going to play at quarterback. I don't think it's going to matter. I just don't. There's nothing that they can do at this point to save this season. They've lost 3 in a row with Daniel Jones, albeit a not healthy Daniel Jones, in a few of those games. But I just don't see how you're going to go beat the Texans, who you already played with Daniel Jones and lost to at home. I don't see how you're going to go beat them on the road. I don't see how you're going to beat the Jaguars, who are fighting for a division title, when you just lost to them with Daniel Jones playing half the game. You were already losing. Then he got injured. Then it got worse. I just don't see it happening. It's a really sad end, though, for the Colts, because, of course, after their 8-2 start to the season, they were a great story of Daniel Jones' resurgence and this young team making the playoffs, but now all of a sudden not looking like that's going to be the case in the AFC. Of course, going back to the NFC for a second before finishing with the AFC, big important result this weekend, while the Panthers were on bye, the Saints went on the road, the 2-10 Saints heading into the week. They upset the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, which means that now the Buccaneers and the Panthers are officially tied at 7-6 atop the NFC South, which is ridiculous. But it's also worth noting they have not played each other a single time this season. So two of their final four games for both teams are against each other at 7-6. They are currently tied at the top of that division. Some very, very interesting games left to be played to decide who is going to get that playoff spot from the NFC South and who's going to miss the playoffs altogether. Because right now, 7-6 is not good enough to be in this race. It's two games back of the Bears and the 49ers. And you still have another team with the Lions as a buffer before you even get to that level. But then, in the AFC, the most important matchup of the weekend, the Steelers beating the Ravens 27-22. That meant both of those teams 6-6 heading into the game. The winner was going to come out on top in the AFC North for the moment. Were the Steelers the rightful winner? No. Isaiah Likely caught that ball. That was a touchdown. I'm not... We can talk about the endless debate of the endless debates of what's a catch and what's not a catch for years, and have done that for years, and will continue to do that for years. But I think clear as day that catch in the end zone by Isaiah Likely was a touchdown. I can't be told otherwise. I don't really care. There's no such thing as a football move in the... I know that that's what the rule says, but there's no such thing as a football move in the end zone. The football move is to catch the ball, take two steps, and spike the ball for a touchdown, and call it a day. There is no he took two steps and the defender had his arm between him and then finally broke it up. It just doesn't make any sense. So an unfortunate loss for the Ravens, and yet at the same time, they need to play cleaner football because they shouldn't have had that game come down to a few calls. And they did in the end also have a chance to win it, notwithstanding those calls, and they couldn't do that. So they have more issues than just a few calls not going their way. They need to clean up a lot if they want to actually make the playoffs. And fortunately for them, they will have another opportunity to play the Steelers. So just go beat the Steelers the next time you play them, I think is kind of the way to go about this. They also play the Bengals again, who they just lost to. So just go beat the Bengals the next time you play them. Easier said than done, but it is all still in front of them. And then in the final game that we'll talk about, or in the final AFC-only game that we'll talk about for the week, the Texans beat the Chiefs. This was a really, really important game because the Chiefs at 6-7 at this point in the year, this is too deep of a hole to dig out of. It's just way too deep. You cannot go two games back. Obviously, the Colts losing Daniel Jones makes a big difference because it doesn't really feel like they'll be in play for that final spot. But the Chiefs just lost the tiebreaker to the Texans, who are at 8-5 and currently would be the last team in the playoffs. I just don't see how at the end of the season, I mean, the Chiefs would have to rattle off four wins in a row and just hope that the Texans lose multiple games on the way there. And the Texans play the Cardinals and the Raiders in the next 2 weeks. So they are not going to lose either of those games. They're also not going to lose to the Colts without Daniel Jones. So I see three wins on the Texans schedule. I see them getting to 11 this year. I think the same thing with the Bills and the Chargers. There just isn't really a path for the Chiefs anymore after losing this game 20-10. And really, just a disappointing season all around for the Chiefs. They made a lot of mistakes as the year went on. Some games they needed their defense to step up and they couldn't. This game their defense stepped up and their offense couldn't. I think that's kind of the story of the year. Obviously, last year they had like the best record in one possession games, I think, of all time. I think they were like 12-0 or something like that. And this year it's been the opposite. They've lost every single close game as opposed to winning every single close game like they did last year. And, you know, I would say a lot of that is a lot of regression. A lot of people said last year that's just the clutch factor of this team. I think they just regressed to the mean this year. I think overall they are a clutch team, but they're not the best clutch team of all time, especially defensively. I think it makes sense that over the last 2 years, they're probably now 11 or 12 and 5 or 6, something in that realm, in those types of games. I think that makes a lot of sense. It's just that it happened to be that one year they won all of those games and the next year they lost all of those games instead of having a little bit more of a balance. But of course, for the Texans, very, very important that they were able to stay afloat with Davis Mills playing quarterback. And now that CJ Stroud is back, they look like themselves again. And I will no longer talk about how this team is overrated, because that defense has just gotten better throughout the year. And really, even at the beginning of the year, the story was their defense was great, and their offense was not enough to get wins on the board. But as the season has gone on, their defense has gone from great to, like, all-time great. This is one of the better defenses we've seen in a while, and it's worth noting that this is an era where offense is dominating the league, and this team just doesn't give up points. I mean, 208 points allowed on the season through 13 games. I'm not a mathematician, but that's pretty good. They're 20 points ahead of the next team. And of course, those two are the Seahawks and the Rams, who we have also talked about as maybe best defensive units in the league. But the Texans are three touchdowns better than both of those teams. So worth noting that. And then, of course, finally, I don't think I want to put too much stock into this game because I don't know what I was watching. But the Chargers did beat the Eagles in overtime. Very important, of course, for the Chargers, who are still chasing down that playoff spot. And also important for the Eagles because when the Cowboys lost, they had an opportunity to go win this game and really, really put that divisional race away, but they were not able to do so, obviously coming up with this loss.
All right, a few quick thoughts. You alluded to the Texans offline as the 85 Bears in terms of defense. So, yes, extremely, extremely impressive. And with respect to the touchdown controversy, why can't the NFL make a different rule for catches in the end zone, like they do for if you hit the pylon, any part of the pylon, the plane of the goal extends. True. If you jump over the pile, the minute the ball breaks the plane, the play is dead. You don't have to maintain, you know, control. The play is dead as soon as you in every other place. There's exceptions for the end zone. Why is it not that as soon as you have 2 feet down and control the ball in the end zone, whistle's dead? It's why should it be harder? Why should it be more stringent?
At least standing up. Understand going to the ground. That's still the same rule.
But why is it any more stringent than jumping over the pile? Sticking the ball out, it gets knocked out a millisecond afterwards. Makes no sense. I have a feeling the competition committee is going to clean that up in the offseason. Then again, you never know what that competition committee does. Everybody has their own biases and their own views on things. All right, let's move off of football and do a quick recap of the last week of action in the NBA.
The Pistons are still leading in the East at 19-5. Not too far behind them are the Knicks, who have had a big surge this week, winning three in a row to get 16-7. They're about at the level they should be. And then surprisingly, despite all the injuries, despite everything that you can say about this team, in a wide-open East, supposedly, because the Celtics are supposed to have a down year, well, the Celtics aren't having a down year. They're at 15-9. They've won five in a row. No Jason Tatum, no problem. They're the 3 seed right now. Of course, you know, with Jason Tatum playing, this team is probably not the 3 seed. They're probably the 1 seed, but still worth noting, they haven't gone anywhere. They've won 5 in a row now. Then you have the Raptors, who have come down to earth a little bit. They've lost 3 in a row. They're at 15-10. The Magic, 7-3 in their last 10. They're 14-10 on the season, which is the same record as the Heat, who have lost 3 in a row. They're also falling back down to earth. And then you have a giant mess of 3 teams that are right behind, literally by a half a game. Behind the Magic and the Heat for the 5th and 6th seeds, the Sixers at 13-10, the Cavs and the Hawks at 14-11 each. Surprised to see the Cavs down there, but they indeed are. They're 4-6 in their last 10. Need to clean it up a little bit. And then there is a Grand Canyon-sized gap between the race for the, 5 through 9 seeds and the 10 seed, because you go from 14-11 Atlanta at the 9 to the 10-15 Bucks. At the 10 spot. They have lost 2 in a row and are in 8 of their last 10. And then the Bulls somehow are tied for that spot at 9-14, despite also losing 8 of their last 10, and 7 in a row overall. And then you have the bottom of the conference, of course, the Hornets at 7-17, who got Brandon Miller back recently. Then he got injured again. Don't know if he's still out long term, but I saw a pretty ugly fall that he took only a few games after coming back. The Nets, who have gotten some excitement out of good play from Michael Porter Jr. and also Danny Wolfe coming up and making a big impact in his first few games back with the G League or back from the G League team. Then you have the Pacers at 6-18 and the Wizards at 3-19. And moving on to the West, anybody want to guess who's in first place? Could it be the Oklahoma City Thunder? Of course it's the Oklahoma City Thunder. Now, all of a sudden, we talked about the fact that they were at least pushing 70 wins this year. And could stretch that all the way to maybe the wins record on the pace they're on. And now they have extended that winning streak that at the time I think was maybe 11 games or 10 games. Well, it's 15 now. They're 23-1 on the season. Nobody's catching this team. I mean, currently, you know, you do the math and this team, they're 23-1. You multiply everything by four or by three, and all of a sudden you realize that this team is on pace for like a 78-4 season, which probably isn't going to keep up, but I wouldn't put it past them. Jalen Williams has now come back. They've looked even better since then. Pretty ridiculous stuff going on in OKC. But meanwhile, you have the Lakers who almost made it three out of four losses, but recovered against the Sixers. LeBron having his best game of the season by far to help the Lakers to that win. They are 8-2 in their last 10 to get to 17-6. They're tied with the Nuggets, who are also 17-6 and have won three in a row. The Rockets are right behind them, and so are the Spurs at 15-6 and 16-7. And then you have the Timberwolves at 15-9, which, of course, would be good enough for the 3 seed in the East, but it's the 6 seed in the West. And then things start to take a little bit of a fall off. The Suns at 14-10 are in the 7 seed. Currently, they've been playing better recently, despite a little bit of a depleted roster. No Jalen Green for a bit, too, but they've still been winning some games. Then the Warriors at 13-12 in the 8 seed. The Grizzlies at 11-13 somehow in a playoff or play-in spot. 7-3 in their last 10, and then the Blazers at 9-15 round out the playoff teams. Despite everything that has happened to that team, they're still in the playoff spot, although just a half game behind them, the Mavericks, who've just gotten AD back and have a pretty good rookie in Cooper Flagg, and then, of course, the Utah Jazz at 8-15, so the Mavericks probably going to take one of those two spots. Wouldn't shock me at all, frankly, if they took it next week and then held on to it for the rest of the season now that AD is back. But then you have the Kings at 6-18, the Clippers at 6-18, who just want to give OKC a better pick, and the Pelicans at 3-22, although, you know, obviously that's the end of the standings. But I would like to say the Chris Paul whole saga unfolded this week. Shame on the Clippers for being such a bad organization in terms of winning. You are 6-18. The least you can do is give the best player in franchise history a proper farewell tour. What they did to him is it's just shameful. There's no franchise other than frankly, I didn't think the Clippers would do this either, but I can't think of a franchise who would do anything like that to a star that literally defined their only successful era in team history. This is just so wrong on so many levels, for what CP3 has meant to that team, to that organization, to just literally throw him out in the middle of the night when your plane was getting delayed, to your next destination. I mean, it's just ridiculous. I could go on and on and on about it, but I mean, really the only word I think you can use is shameful. It's just such a bad look, for that organization. I think a lot of fans pretty upset about that, both league wide and also, in terms of the few Clippers fans that do exist.
Yeah. And here we thought the Clippers ineptitude of an organization ended with Steve Ballmer taking over, and looks like this and other things that they've done or have alleged to have done, might not have changed. This might be different ways they're making stupid moves. All right, let's move off of NBA action and move to college basketball action from the last week.
Well, it was surprisingly, it's weird. It's the rebound week from Feast Week. There were a lot of good games this week, and it started with Duke playing Florida. I mean, the main reason why there were a lot of good games is because it was SEC-ACC Challenge Week. Duke beat number 15 Florida 67-66. Obviously a very expected result, although honestly, Florida staying competitive in this game was a pretty big sign of progress for them, because I didn't think they would be competitive in this game, but they looked good. I don't think they look too bad this year. I think that's all I really have to say. This is probably the best game they've played all year long. It sucks that, you know, the best game they played all year long is a loss, but that's what happens when you're playing Duke. Then you have number 5 UConn, who beat number 21 Kansas 61-56. UConn getting Braylon Mullins back, getting Terrace Reed back, getting healthier and getting better, which is scary because they're already in the top 5. And they just keep looking better and better and better as the year goes on. Of course, only the close loss to Arizona at home without each of those two aforementioned players. So this team is getting better. This team is getting healthier. I will like to see their progress unfold as the season unfolds. And frankly, there is not another team in the Big East that is anywhere near this level. UConn could have a pretty... they could end up looking like a Gonzaga record by the time we hit the NCAA tournament, based on The slow start that St. John's has been off to, and frankly, the rest of that entire conference, outside of a few bubble teams like Villanova, Butler and Seton Hall, who have kind of just defied expectations to have solid seasons. But also, in addition to the SEC-ACC Challenge, Big Ten play started this week. Number 7 Michigan State beat Iowa 71-52. Number 24 USC beat Oregon 82-77, a really close game on the road that probably shouldn't have been that close. But they stayed undefeated with that win. And then Minnesota, with the upset of the week, arguably, beating number 22 Indiana 73-64. Upset of the week in the conference, for sure. But upset in the week in the country, I think, has to be Syracuse beating number 13 Tennessee 62-60. This is a team that has struggled for a while, despite being a name brand, to get really important wins on the board. Haven't even sniffed the tournament picture, let alone the tournament itself, but even gotten anywhere near it. I don't even think I've named them as a bubble team in the last 3 years. But this year, they looked a part of a team that could at least be floating somewhere around the bubble come the committee's decision time. It wouldn't shock me at all based on how they've been playing. I really like the Syracuse team. I don't think they're necessarily, a contender, but they're good enough to get a win like this. That means they're good enough to compete in the ACC for sure. Speaking of competing in the ICC, number 16 North Carolina beat number 18 Kentucky 67-64. This, of course, was before the game that we mentioned on predictions where Kentucky would lose 94-59 to Gonzaga. Just spiraling out of control is their season. But then number 25 Arkansas beat number 6 Louisville 89-80. It's worth noting that the ACC actually led this challenge between the ACC and the SEC 6-2 after the first night. Then you looked at the matchups for the second night, and you went, oh, if Louisville doesn't win this one, it's going to get real ugly for the ACC, and that is what happened. Arkansas beat Louisville, as I just said. Alabama beat Clemson at home. Vanderbilt beat SMU at home. Auburn beat NC State at home, and all of a sudden, the SEC ended up winning the challenge 9-7. However, I think it's worth noting that last year, again, the SEC won this challenge 14-2. So 9-7. Is a pretty big improvement for the ACC, even though they lost. That's 5 games better than they were last year. And frankly, the best team in the conference, arguably, well, not arguably, I think Duke is the best team in the conference, but the second best team in the conference, arguably, lost. So you were your second best team winning a game away from tying this challenge, which is a pretty good result for the ACC. I really think they come out of this looking a lot better than the SEC does, because the SEC is nowhere near as dominant as it was in years past. I think people will be shocked at not the lack of tournament teams, but you're not going to be able to do what Oklahoma did last year and make the tournament from the SEC, is all I will say. You cannot just go undefeated and go like 6-12 in conference and that's enough. There aren't going to be enough high-level wins for that to happen. It'll look more like, some of the Big Ten pictures of the past where, 10-10 in conference has been enough to get in to the tournament. That has always been the watermark in the Big Ten. I think you can probably get in at 7, and I think 7-11 maybe, depending on your schedule. 8-10 probably, based on how the SEC has played in the non-con, depending on who you are. But it's a far cry from last year, where multiple 6-12 and 7-11 teams were not only vying for tournament spots, but pretty easily in when all things were said and done. But still, a really good conference this year. Just not quite all-time dominant. Still, though, probably the best in the country. And if it's not them, it's the Big 12, who had a really big weekend themselves. Even though they had no challenges or anything like that to prove it, they went and decided to just go out and play good games. Number 10 Iowa State went on the road, beat Purdue, as we talked about in predictions. Number 2 Arizona beat number 20 Auburn 97-68, looking very much like Michigan did against Auburn when they played on a neutral court, although Arizona did this at home. And then Duke, we talked about, beat Michigan State on the road. Louisville rebounded from that loss against Arkansas and easily handled Indiana 87-78. Final score a lot closer and less indicative of how not close this game actually was. Louisville was dominating this game, winning by, they were up like 16-4 or something early in the game and never really looked back. It was basically double digits the entire way. Illinois, as we talked about, beat Tennessee, a big win on the board for a team that's vying for the third or fourth best spot in the Big Ten, maybe the second best, depending on how you look at Purdue and Michigan State right about now. But then St. John's beat Ole Miss A good win for the Johnnies, who just need wins on the board because, of course, they haven't gotten many wins in their marquee games. They lost to Alabama. They went 1-2 in the Players' Era Challenge. They need to get some wins on the board. Washington finally put USC's undefeated reign to an end. They beat them on the road 84-76. Big win for the Huskies, who are going to be a factor on the bubble and at least in the middle of the pack in the Big Ten, but remains to be seen what this team's ceiling could be when they finally get fully healthy. Then you have some other important games over the weekend. Number 19, Texas Tech beat LSU 82-58. LSU previously undefeated. And of course, worth noting, Texas Tech, Big 12 team again, Big 12 getting a big win. Number 16, North Carolina beat Georgetown 81-61. So continuing their good start to the season. And speaking of the Big 12, Kansas beat Missouri 80-60. So another Big 12 over SEC victory. Again, Big 12 winning the weekend for sure. Arizona's win, Iowa State's win, Kansas's win, Texas Tech's win. You look all around and those teams aren't losing at all. And this one by Kansas, pretty dominant and a pretty good showing from Darren Peterson in his return from injury. Of course, they've been really good without him. They look a lot better with him. Kansas, no ceiling on this team, frankly, the way they've been playing without him. They had a lot of time to gel, and that also is really important because now all of their secondary and tertiary options, they have confidence that they can go out and win a game if they need to. It's not just going to be on the hands of a freshman or on the shoulders of a freshman. So Peterson, he'll obviously still star in this offense and be the feature guy, but he doesn't need to be in some games. They clearly have the big game experience and winning pedigree to be able to win those games, even if he's not on his best performance that night. And then finally, an unofficial addendum to the ACC-SEC challenge, I guess you could say. SMU beat Texas A&M 93-80 in overtime. So after the SEC, of course, won the ACC-SEC challenge 9-7, you do get one ACC win against an SEC team on the board, which means that technically, if you were to add this game to that challenge, it was more like 9-8 over the course of the week. Although, of course, that's not how the challenge works. But again, just another sign that, you know, the middle of the ACC right now is a lot closer to the middle of the SEC than it was last year, although a lot of people would say that was more like a top half of the ACC against bottom third of the SEC game. So it's worth, you could go back and forth on those positions for a while, but SMU getting an important win, probably should be a ranked team this week if they're not already, and probably next week because they're undefeated so far, and they've had a pretty good season and were a bubble team last year. So a lot of belief in the Mustangs, at least on my end.
All right, well, that wraps up our look at college basketball for the week. It also wraps this edition of the 4th and 24 podcast. Please be sure to check out our next podcast, which will be on Tuesday, December 16th. Tuesday, December 16th, where we will once again talk about Patrick's weekend predictions. We will, as mentioned, preview the college football playoff and bowl season. We will review week 15 in the NFL and have our weekly review of basketball action, looking back at the NBA and college basketball. In the meantime, please be sure to check out Patrick's picks for his next weekend's games, which will be posted always on Thursday, and his College Hoops Bracketology, which comes out every Monday. All of that content is on our social media handles at 4th and 24. That's the number 4, THAND, plus the number 24 on social media handles. Thank you for listening.